hi everyone. My name is Vincent, and today I'm going to talk to you guys about data science. And just so I can get a glimpse of what the room is like, who is a practitioner of data science? So does data science day to day? Kind of. Okay, who is kind of curious what data science is? Right? How many of you do business intelligence kind of stuff? Okay, so this it seems like I'm going to be talking to the right crowd then. My name is Vincent. I'm sort of the open source guy that has been doing data science for a while. I'm with this company that does a lot of data science. I'm the co-founder of PyData Amsterdam. I'm a preferred RStudio partner. But mainly, I'm this guy. What happened was I was done with college at some point as an econometrician, which is a nice little shiny degree. And usually people say, oh, I should go for McKinsey, and you should go for Boston Consulting Group and all these sorts of companies. And, you know, that was fun and all, but instead I kind of did this traveling the world thing. I was kind of lucky because I did this in 2012, and I was one of the first data scientists out there. And I was able to do a lot of this stuff because I was doing open source. And it turns out, if there's Wi-Fi anywhere around the world, and if I have access to a cloud environment, my employer, I was an independent contractor, didn't mind paying me if I was abroad as long as I was half off. Now, even if you earn half off, earning euros and spending pesos is a good thing, especially if you're in Latin America. So this was my office for a day in Machu Picchu. This was my office in Buenos Aires that I lived in for quite a bit. This is a Miraflores. You have to imagine that's in Lima. And there's this one park that actually has Wi-Fi. It's sort of a rich people area. And like the rest of everything's a ghetto, but that one park has Wi-Fi. Berlin is basically one big office. You can just go into a club and put your laptop down and no one beats an eye. There was this cool place in Barranco, which is basically this surfer guy who said, hey, you can stay at my house for free if you fix my website. And I had a GoPro with me. And if we put the GoPro videos on his website, he said, sure, let's just have you around and then you can get free surfing lessons as well. Then I had this nice little place in Lima, also super cheap, super nice, nice view and all. Montevideo was cool. Believe it or not, there's even Wi-Fi in the Amazons nowadays. So, and the Wi-Fi in the Amazons is actually better than in Buenos Aires. The thing is, if you're there in low season, there's a satellite connection per town that is connecting Wi-Fi via the satellite. And if you're in low season, you'll be the only guy using it. The colleagues are not that different, even if you're going to the Amazons. Sometimes I still go surfing. I don't do it as much anymore because I almost broke my wrist the last time. But I went to Malaga, and you know, I could also convince my employer to do some work there. That's completely fine. I visited Chicago to see a couple of old friends of mine. If you go to San Francisco, you have these co-working spaces. And again, your colleagues are not that different, even if you're in enterprise. But the nice thing about San Francisco, you can, when you're done working, you have this sort of wonderful nature outside. And the vibe is nice, and the lifestyle is great. This was my office content for that half year. And something happened because suddenly I had to come back from this trip and explain to my grandfather, yeah, I'm a 24-year-old. I just traveled the world. And I worked for 2 days a week. And I was able to pay the entire trip. I didn't make any costs whatsoever. So I had a huge savings account for this travel. And I didn't have to spend a dime to do this. There are these sorts of weird moments where there isn't Wi-Fi. But if you really have these moments, you have to imagine that you can prepare for these moments as well. So life isn't that hard either. Pretty much is a lifestyle we can do nowadays. So again, I'm explaining this to my grandfather, and my grandfather cannot understand what's happened. So what I'm going to try to do and explain to you guys is why people care about the stuff that I'm able to do, and what's different in business intelligence, and sort of help you guys understand how the world is changing that I am able to do this. Because the main reason that I was able to do this, I didn't have to pay a license fee to do my software. And you know, I have a pretty good maths background. And because of the internet, I can teach myself how to code. It's not something that you'd have to get a degree for. You can go into Udacity or EDX and teach yourself Python within a year to the extent you can be the co-founder of PyData Amsterdam. It's not that hard. The only reason that I was able to do this was because open source was there. It's very plain and simple. If there wasn't any open source, I couldn't have used software that other people use, and I would have been able to be as productive as I was in the Amazons as I'm, maybe if I had like a, even if I had to buy for a license for SPSS and I would have to read all the manuals, it would not have been as effective than just picking up the R manual. There was a few other things that were happening. So it was about 2012, so BI was still kind of big and still kind of hypey, so as a practice, as a title. And I was one of the first people who was in BI that said, nah, I don't think this is the future per se. I want to be able to do stuff with open source code and also maybe do a little bit more machine learning. Back in the day, you can still make a lot of decent salary if you're a BI guy. But nowadays, the emphasis is a little bit more on the machine learning side. I also wasn't afraid to learn R, Python, and JavaScript, and even a little bit of Scala from scratch. You can actually do it. If you understand Excel, it's just a 2-month investment to be able to speak one of these languages and apply it in practice. It's not that hard. It helps if you have a good mentor, if you have a good example. Come talk to me if you're interested in this. I give free trainings once in a while. But you don't need it. I started out from scratch and I was able to do this just fine. It does turn out, though, that I was such a big believer in open source. This was sort of back in the day in 2012. It turns out that I'm somewhat rare still. And if not for open source, I wouldn't have stuck in BI. There's still a lot of people that go to college, and only thing that they are taught is SPSS. Right? I mean, I don't know if you guys were taught SPSS or MATLAB, but it's not like R or Python are skills that are taught in universities so much. I think that's still kind of the case. It's getting better. But nowadays, people are trying to learn these languages for crazy. And the reason kind of is that it goes to ridiculous lengths. So this is an actual, I literally have the keyword bingo on my LinkedIn profile, and this is what is listed. And I would just like to have you guys look at it and see if you understand the joke. And again, I kind of want to just emphasize that we're also in sort of a bubble at the moment. And if you look at this long enough, then you should be able to have a laugh and understand, yes, if you can get away with this, we are definitely in a bubble. Yeah, there's a couple of Pokemon names in here. And there are these moments that I'm talking to this enterprise recruiter person, and then they say, Vincent, we have this wonderful enterprise career path for you. Are you interested? And I say, sure, but I only want to work with the latest technology. So, you know, Spark, Hadoop, and Crebase, and Azurill. And they say, oh, we work with all of those. And then and then I point out to them, dude, those are Pokemon. Are you serious? Can I be a Pokemon master at your company? And the recruiters, it's not like they say, fine, I'll look for someone else. They still try to hire me. We are in some sort of bubble at the moment. And this is an interesting sign, because it feels like everyone wants to be a data scientist these days, but it's not super clear what a data scientist actually is or does and where the sort of applied value is. Because, you know, a business intelligence person is also doing stuff with data, and a data scientist is also doing stuff with data. And surely it's not just my arrogant attitude towards recruiters that people want to hire me. So what are some things that are happening? So what you can do is you can go to Google Trends, and you just type in a word, and you can see over time how much the keyword has gained popularity. So for example, just out of the blue, RStudio, NumPy, and Julia. These are all open source languages that people can use to do stuff with code. NumPy is a module in Python, RStudio is a company heavily invested in R, and Julia is a hipster-ish new programming language that might gain traction someday, ever. Maybe. So this is open source, and we can see it's going up. And this is SAS and SPSS. One thing that is interesting, of course, that you can sort of see the seasonality appearing here. So you can see when students need to buy a license from their professor. But we definitely see a trend going up, and we see a trend going down. And you can do one more step with these Google Trends, and you can sort of say, okay, the company that I work for, we've been doing Hadoop for a while, since 2009. Hadoop is a technology to handle big data sets. It really has been around for quite a while. People started doing it in 2007, and I guess in 2009 it actually started getting into production with clients in the Netherlands. But then around 2013 we hit this moment that the term big data became more popular than the solution for the problem. And this gap has only been getting bigger. So it seems that people are very much interested in the tooling and the solutions and all this, but no one is really learning the tools for some reason. That's sort of an impression I have when I look at this. And it goes a bit further. Like, even if you go to the SPSS website, there's this button that says, you know, there's the SPSS Statistics Developer Edition where you can use R and Python in SPSS. Which also kind of feels sort of weird. So even these enterprise products really want to emphasize that you're able to use open source even within their stack. So something is up. Let's try to figure out what the difference really is. Of course, one thing that helps is that these are open source users. If you go online, some of the free courses that you can actually do in data science are given by Microsoft, Facebook, and Google. And these people have been using open source for years. It does seem, though, that open source is getting a little bit more traction because it's a little bit more accessible the last couple of years, I would say. Ask me anything later. I am involved with both the RStudio project and PyData Amsterdam. If you want to know more about this, I would gladly go in depth, but I don't have the time for this talk. If you want to learn about this stuff, I know people who give free training in this, so contact me afterwards. But to really explain to you what the difference is between data science and the big data tools and what BI people usually do, I have these two examples. And they're from the video game world, I would say. The reason for this is I have data from clients, but I've signed this nifty little NDA that says I cannot just go ahead and share that with you guys. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you how I am able to get better at these video games by using data science, and hopefully you guys can understand that if I get better at video games, maybe running a business can be seen as a video game as well. So hopefully we understand there's something up with data science. Maybe try a little example to show you guys what the difference is between a BI person and a data science person. So let's start with Pokemon. So everyone knows the app game, right? So the thing that people have on the iPhones, catch Charmander and that kind of stuff. How many people have a recollection of this? Does anyone maybe have kids that play the Game Boy game? I will, because there's not too many hands, I'm just going to go ahead and explain what the video game does. So the idea basically is quite cruel. You have basically two animals fighting each other. And some animals are strong and other animals are weak. And there's this rock, paper, scissors element in the game. A plant Pokemon is very weak against a fire Pokemon. A fire Pokemon is very weak against a water Pokemon. And a water Pokemon is very weak against a plant Pokemon. So if you want to, you get to pick a couple of Pokemon, you have to pick the best ones, and then you can sort of beat other people in this fighting scheme. And the question I then had is, can I make a recommendation engine that will tell you what the best Pokemon are? That way it's much easier to win the game. Just pick those Pokemon and you'll probably always win. So that's sort of the task that I'm trying to solve. And immediately you should understand that this is a decision that I'm trying to make. I want to be able to make this decision better. And I'm not so much interested in a chart. I'm not so much interested in seeing a summary statistic. This one decision has to be made a bit better. And preferably, I would make this decision within an afternoon. So I could, you know, put a PhD on the project, and in 4 years' time, I might get an answer. Preferably, I just want to hack around and solve this within a day, and then move on and solve something else. So the first thing you then do is check, have other people solve this problem. It turns out there's this paper that says classic Nintendo games are computationally hard. There's this NP hardness proof, if that says anything to you, if you're a computer scientist, that says that Donkey Kong, Legend of Zelda, Metroid, and Pokemon, as well as Mario Brothers 1 through 3, are, in theory, unsolvable problems. But that's fine. Because the thing is, I don't have to solve the exact problem. I just make a small assumption. I'll just think of a model that might just go ahead and work. And then I figured, okay, so someone tried to solve the problem and then failed. That means I have to come up with something myself. How about just go on to fan websites? And if you go to fan websites, you basically get the formula of, hey, if this Pokemon is this level, it has this many hit points, and then depending on the attack points and the defense points of this Pokemon, and then sort of a coefficient for if it's a plant or water Pokemon, I can determine how many turns one Pokemon will outlive the other. If the formulas are scary, forget them. The only thing I'm calculating here is how many turns will one Pokemon outlive the other. By looking at the hit points and looking at the damage, and there's a bit of formula for that, but this is the only math that I'll be doing. This is my very, very simple model. I'm assuming that Pokemon just basic attack each other on and on and on and on. So I have this. Okay, this is the beginning of a model. And then there turns out to be this website called PokeApi.co, where you can actually download all the Pokemon data for free. So I did that. I know how to program, so it was fairly simple, just pull in all the data. So now I have a data set, and I have a beginning of a model, so I can start maybe doing stuff. And so far, what I've done might still be something you would expect from the realm of BI. What you see for you here is now a chart of all the Pokemons. You should imagine these are all the Pokemons sorted by Pokemon Index. If it's red here, that means that this Pokemon is beaten by that Pokemon. If it's very green here, that means, so of course it's sort of symmetric, right? So if this Pokemon loses against the rest wins against that Pokemon. So this is sort of cool, and I guess a good BI tool could visualize this for you as well. But you should recognize I am nowhere near a decision at this point. This is cool, it's a nice visualization, I can hang it up in my sort of company wall and I have a nice little bit of info porn, but I've not made the decision yet, so I'm not done. If the BI tool was a bit better, I could go a little bit further and I could cluster Pokemon by type, so, you know, fire Pokemons together and then the water Pokemons together, and then you get a little bit more information now, because you sort of see the clusters, right? You notice that some Pokemon are always weak against a different type. So already this is giving me more information. Again, this is sort of what BI does. It gives me information, but it doesn't necessarily make the decision for me. And for me personally, that's where I sort of draw the line where BI sort of stops and data science sort of begins. The whole point of data science is just to use data to make better decisions. be it maybe automated, recommendation engine, or to make one decision much more informed. In this case, I want to make the one decision much more informed, and this is not sufficient. So now I just need to think of this. I've made an okay-ish model. I like the way I can score if a Pokemon is better than another one, but it turns out I need something more. And the only thing I can use then is my own creativity. And then I started thinking, well, you know, I've been doing this for about 2.5 hours, and I figured, okay, I like what I see, but I want to make the decision a little bit more automated, so how about I just look at a Pokemon as if it's a time series. So I would say, every Pokemon has an average score. In this case, how much is green, how much is red, that's the average. I can also have this notion of variance, as in, how often does this Pokemon deviate from the average score. I don't mind if a Pokemon is pretty good, and quite consistently, that's kind of fine, but I do mind if the average is fantastic, but it's not very consistent. If on average it always wins, except if it's against one of these 10 Pokemon, then it always loses, it might still be a poor choice for the stuff I'm interested in. So I want the Pokemon to be consistent, and I want the Pokemon to have a good average. Okay, so per Pokemon, I will now calculate these two values. Again, here's the formula, don't worry too much about it. This is just calculating the mean, this is just calculating the variance, and I will do this for every single Pokemon, and I'll just plot that. So this is the risk per Pokemon, this is the average per Pokemon. So far, so good, because now the thing just becomes a little bit more easy, because now I can just say, okay, give me the ones that have low risk, and give me the ones that have a high mu. High mu being average, so give me the ones that have a good average score. So let's just pick these 5 Pokemon. If you're interested, that's Mewtwo, Lapras, Dragonite, Snorlax, and Rhydon. this is sort of the beginning of a story, because I wrote this basically because I got in a bit of a kerfuffle with this guy in London. I was at the Strata conference, and basically, I don't want to be rude, but you know these banker types that are very arrogant? Like with hair backwards, and they say, oh, dude, I totally now pwned that option firm, and I totally bought all, the, oh, I have an optimal portfolio of stocks. And I basically said, dude, I can calculate an optimal portfolio of Pokemon. That's how I sort of got started with this, and this turned out to be a bit of a blog post. Then this happened to my blog. This was a blog post meant as a small joke I sent out to a couple of people. And then suddenly I had this huge spike, which happened in about an hour. So I figured, gee, what's that? And the nice thing about having a blog is you put Google Analytics on it, and you can take your steps back and see where the traffic actually came from. Turns out it came from the Pokemon fan club on Reddit. This is not a joke, but if you think this is funny, wait till you see the next bit. The Pokemon fans in general, because you read the thread, the Pokemon fans in general did not agree that my model was correct. Whatsoever, they totally did not agree. They did agree that my model output made sense, though. And this is sort of the whole point. I am by no means a domain expert in Pokemon. Like, by no means. I played the game when I was 12, and when I was 12, I was an idiot. I really don't know what the game is about, but by just using a bit of data and hacking stuff together, making small assumptions to just make sure I can get the job done within a day, it seems like I've been able to make a pretty good estimate, pretty good decision, without having to put all the effort in learning how the game works. And this is kind of true for a lot of stuff I do in data science. There was an article that said Pokemon is relatively complicated. Supposedly, it's NP-hard. But I've been able to find a very good tactic without any domain knowledge, and the main thing that's of interest here is my investment time ratio is quite good. So I invest a little bit of time in it, and actually I'm able to get a very good answer back with the very limited time that I actually put in. The payback to time ratio is something I always try to optimize. If you ever hire a data scientist, make sure they understand this, because otherwise you're hiring a PhD, not a data scientist. So a couple of takeaways from just this one example, right? We can quickly bootstrap solutions for problems with open source tools if we have the data. If you don't have this data, maybe consider generating it. You can still do a lot of stuff with simulations. I have a blog post on how to find a good Monopoly tactic, and I didn't have any data for it, so I just simulated it myself. You can also maybe scrape it from the internet. In this case, I scraped Pokemon. Data is available in a lot of sources. There's a lot of open sources nowadays. You might actually just be able to hack stuff around and get a quick solution, just a minimal amount of data. In this case, I use video games, but obviously this approach goes a bit beyond video games. We can really make the world or a business a whole lot better if you just use data. You just need a bit of creativity. And in my experience, there's a group of people that is very much interested in dashboards and sort of doing the bookkeeping on the data from the past. That's very good. We need those people. We want to keep those things in check. But the difference between the data scientists is we try to predict the future because we want to make better decisions. That's sort of, we have a different concern in that sense. Usually you would also have a third person, that's the data engineer. it's nice if I have a nice way to predict the future for a certain user on a website. Suppose I'm making recommendations. I kind of also need a guy or a girl that's able to make sure the whole internet can talk to this service. I might be very good at math, but I'm not the best guy around to do deployment service for hundreds of millions of users. You need a different type of engineer for that. Let's now discuss World of Warcraft, another great video game that you may have heard of. Who has heard of World of Warcraft? Who has played the video game World of Warcraft? Who knows a friend or family member who plays World of Warcraft? Okay, so I'm living in a world now where more people know World of Warcraft than the Pokemon. This is World of Warcraft. And there's a couple of things that are interesting about World of Warcraft. Personally, the fact that this green monster guy is fighting the guy with the shiny sword, that's not so much the interesting thing. There's two interesting things. One interesting thing is this is an epic sword. You have to play super many hours to be able to acquire this sword. You have to sort of invest a month of time to get the best sword for your character. So there's a trading aspect in the game. I think that's interesting because it actually models the economy quite well. And this is a game where people really, really, really seriously spend a lot of time on it. There are people that spend over 40 hours a month just playing this video game, which means that it has become a full-time job for some people to participate in an online hobby. For a lot of reasons, this is very interesting. And turns out, Blizzard had an open API for this, so I could actually pull data in from whatever people on World of Warcraft are doing. It's closed off now, but long story short, I acquired a bit of data on people that are logging in and what people are doing on the auction house. And what I'm doing now is not so much, I don't have a goal in mind, but I'm just interested in what I can learn from this, because it feels like this is a data set where you can learn some interesting stuff from. So this is the World of Warcraft auction house. It's basically like eBay, but for online gold, if you will. So there's this thing called King's Blood, which is nothing else but this online herb you can get, and you can probably make a potion out of it. And you can see that there's this value that you can bid on, and there's this buyout value. So there's sort of this bidding thing that you can actually do. And the nice thing is these are actual players. So this is an actual economic thing happening, and I can actually measure it as opposed to the actual economy that we have. And the very interesting thing there is, this is sort of the discussion I always had with my economics professor, if you look at the assumptions that we have in economics, they make a lot more sense in the video game world than they do in our world. And if any economist is going to say, look, we have these rules of economics, and we should follow them, if I can prove that they don't work in the online world, then certainly we should be very doubtful that they ever work in the real world. So that was sort of my attitude going in. This was sort of why I was thinking this data set might be interesting. So for those of you that don't understand Warcraft, basically as you kill a dragon, you can get the dragon's teeth, you can sell that dragon's teeth for fake gold, you can use that fake gold to buy a potion, and there's this whole ecosystem of stuff that you can buy. The idea is that you buy goods to become better. Once you're better, you get better goods, you sell those to become even better, and the whole thing revolves and revolves and revolves, and it repeats and it repeats. So I think at the moment we have about 10 million players, and we have about 100 identical WoW instances. So there's a World of Warcraft 1, there's a World of Warcraft 2, and not all the players aren't on the same server. The server is split up across different regions. So there's one machine in Brazil where all the Brazilian people play. There's about 50 in the US, there's about 30 in Europe. So I actually, not just do I have data from the World of Warcraft, I have data from all the worlds of Warcraft independently. So if something happens on one server, I can check if it happens on a different server as well, where there's different people playing the same game. Just to give an impression, though, this data set does have a bit of a problem, because the API gave me snapshots every 2 hours of the auction house state. And one such snapshot is about 2 gigabytes of JSON data. I can compress that, all of that's fine. But even on this machine that has 16 gigabytes of memory, at some point it just won't fit on one machine if I want to analyze it. Maybe I can do it in a streaming fashion, but you can imagine I would have to wait a long time before my data gets back, and I like to keep things interactive. If I'm just exploring something, if I don't know what I'm doing quite yet, because I'm just fooling around, I don't want to wait more than 50 seconds for a query to get done. I want to work much, much more interactively, and I kind of want to like to use open source tooling as well. If I'm curious about this, I don't want to spend €1,000, right, to figure out what I'm trying to do. So it would be nice if I have some nice open source way to deal with this problem. So basically, I have this big problem, and I need to figure out how to deal with it. To explain how this problem is solved in the technical world, I'll use a bit of an analogy. What do you want to do if you want to blow up a building? You use a bomb. And what you could do if you want to blow up a much bigger building is you can use a much bigger, way more expensive bomb. The problem, though, is the cost of the bomb doesn't scale linearly. If I need a bomb that's twice as big, it will cost four times as much money at some point. If I want a bomb that's four times as big, I will need to spend 16 times as much money. So economically, this won't scale. What I could do, though, is just use many small ones instead. So instead of using one big bomb to blow up the building, I'll just use a whole lot of small bombs, and economically, that can make more sense. I would like it if I'm able to use commodity hardware that's linked up together and I can do stuff in parallel, than to buy just a big one machine. Economically, that would be very cool. And it would be especially cool if I have some form of cloud environment where I can just rent 60 of these machines for about an hour and then turn them all off and only pay for 1 hour of service. That would be especially cool. So here's a technical solution. It's just to take the small bombs approach. We have this thing called Hadoop, and we have this thing called Spark that runs on top of Hadoop. And the idea is there's one master node that keeps track of where all the files are. There are all these slave nodes, which we can also just call worker nodes. And the idea is we spread the data across all these worker nodes, and whenever we want to do a task, we send the task to a data node, and the system will take care of that everything runs parallel. I just send it, you know, a SQL-esque query or something R or something Spark-based. The idea is I don't have to worry about the parallelism. There's a system called Hadoop and Spark that does that for me. 2 minute introduction into distributed computing. Done. happy. And just to give an impression of how easy or how hard some of these things might be, I also had logs of when people logged in. So I knew character number 9, who was a level 70 orc hunter who was in the Zone of the Barons, part of guild number 79, on this date and on this timestamp was logged in. I also know that 10 minutes after this happened, this person was still logged in. And I'm interested in economic aspects, but I'm also kind of interested in sort of how much time are people spending on World of Warcraft. And to do that, I want to know how long it takes before you can level up to level 70, so to say. And then one problem is what I cannot do. I cannot just say, okay, take this character, take the minimum timestamp, take the maximum timestamp, and subtract those from each other. Because as you can see from this data set, there's this gap. It seems plausible that this person was online during this entire time, but then probably the person went offline here and then came online a couple of hours later. I want to keep track of this. So a thing I need to do whenever I'm doing this and I have a huge dump of data is I need to be able to sessionize it. And it would be very nice if I have a very nice, easy way to do this. Well, sessionizing is not the hardest problem. Basically, what you would do is you would say, hey, take the time difference between this moment and that moment, sort of with a window function. You have this in SQL nowadays as well, I believe. And then you have the difference in time. What you can then do is you can say, hey, if it's a missing value, then it's true. And if this waiting time is anything else than 10, then it's also true. And then you just do a come sum over this. And then basically, per character, I now have a session ID. This is the query that I would have to write if I want to run this on R on top of Hadoop Spark. I say, okay, I have this huge, it's the wrong query. Oh no, epic fail in my presentation, damn. Okay, I will show you the query later. It seems that I've missed a slide here. The main thing I want to tell you guys then is such a thing is something you do in parallel nowadays. The idea is you still have a time series aspect, so you have to keep one time series intact for the entire session. However, you can do this per character, and every character's data can be stored in a different server. So this thing, even though it might be 40 gigabytes of data, can just run in parallel. I have this other query, which was about the auction house data. Still to show how readable the data set is if you just do this in R and Spark, I have the data frame. I'm going to group it by owner. I'm going to summarize it. S will be the sum of the buyout values. I will then sort that by S, and then I will say make a cumulative sum out of this. This query will then run in parallel. And this data frame that I get back, I can plot that. And one thing I can then calculate is what does the 1% of World of Warcraft own on the auction houses? And it turns out that 1% of World of Warcraft owns about 25% of all the auctions on the auction house. If I were Blizzard, the person who's making this game, and if I were interested in finding out who is a bot and who is sort of faking the system, this is an okay algorithm to come with a short list of people who are probably selling a little bit too much than they should if they're a human. A thing you could do. Ah, there's the query. messed up all the slides. Sorry about that. Here's the query for the sessionizing task. So I say, okay, take the data frame, order it by character and by timestamp. Per date and per character, calculate the time between, So and then you have to check, hey, if it's n, if it's not available, or if the time is larger than 10, make it a true, and then take a com sum. What you then end up with is you can make this sort of nice chart out of it, where you can see, hey, this is how much time a user is spending on the platform, and this is the level of the user. You can sort of see that it's leveling up. What you can also sort of quite nicely see is that at some point an expansion came out, because at some expansion you sort of notice that people have a steeper curve, so people are able to level up quicker. This was a change that happened, I think, in Wrath of the Lich King. I don't really play the video game, but I checked this on the blogs, and supposedly it makes sense. However, another thing that I was able to figure out, if I just look at the slope that I have here, the average slope, it seems that it takes about 50 hours or so to gain 10 levels. So if you want to go up to level 60, that means that you need to invest about 600 hours. So the average WoW player that made it to level 60 spent a significant amount of time playing this one video game. Anyway, these are simple questions I had that I just wanted to get answered. Even if I want to do huge, big data tasks, I can also just run that in my open source stuff. And that's sort of the conclusion. I mean, I've just discussed what I can do with video game data, and this is stuff that I do with my hobby, I do it for fun. And the only sort of empowering thing that makes me different than the average BI person is that I can talk differently to computers. Yes, perhaps I also have a math background, and that will help, right? If you don't have a math background, some things might not be as obvious in this algorithmic world. But one thing that certainly is the case, if you can talk to a computer, the computer will just do this for you. And it's very cool if you just can talk to a couple of open source languages that are specialized at these tasks. Because let's be honest, if I look at all the moving parts, this is not a very complicated query. And I'm not worried about parallel computing. I'm not writing the MapReduce query myself. So if you want to get started with large data sets, ask around for this thing called Cloudera and Spark. I can highly recommend the Cloudera thing. If you're doing something with Hadoop, I think they're the best one out there. I even have a couple of colleagues that ensure that it works on top of Azure. So if you're into Azure, try to ask around for the Cloudera stuff. It works quite well. If your data set is small, though, try to get started with R and Python. It's not that much of an investment. Just buy a book, read up on it. It's not the most complicated thing. The world will literally open up for you. I'll be around for the entire conference. Ask me anything. I will not be able to share you anything that I did specifically for my clients, but I do know a thing or two that might be able to help you get started, and especially if you're interested in free training, I give that once in a while. Please welcome yourself to the open source jungle.